This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Bob in Euston. Hello, Bob.
Hello there, Mr. Clay.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but what I'd like to ask you is, I don't think I have the stomach to torture people, but I don't see anything wrong in a government doing it when you're fighting terrorists who have no qualms about walking into a shopping mall and blowing everybody up in there. The only way we're ever going to beat these people is to fight fire with fire. We keep fighting them using conventions and not fighting dirty, and they're fighting dirty, and we'll never beat them unless we start using the tactics they use.
Bob, there was someone laughing behind with you. I couldn't disagree with you more.
Why, Deputy Prime Minister?
Well, because firstly, and most importantly of all, just morally speaking, if you are defending the values of decency, dignity before the law, human rights, that's what we do in democracies, unlike them. That's what we do, unlike those barbarians, those animals in ISIL. We stand up for values that we've cherished for centuries. And if we instead lower ourselves to their level, use their methods, use their way of, you know, treating people with in such a sort of degrading way by using torture, then, you know, then we destroy the very values we're trying to protect from their attacks. And that's the first point. The second point is, and this is a more prosaic point, but it's an important one to make, which is that according to the Senate Committee's report, which this explosive report, which makes very, very shocking reading indeed, that came out earlier this week in Washington, they don't think it actually kept us any safer anyway. So I don't agree, Bob, with your assertion, or at least the people who wrote the Senate committee report don't agree with your assertion that somehow that would be a more effective way of keeping us safe. So I think on moral grounds and legal grounds, but also on practical grounds, I strongly disagree with you. And if we're going to try and stop people becoming radicalised and going to fight for these horrific organisations like ISIL, we have to show in the way in which we conduct the conflict with them that we operate by different standards to them, that we're not the same.
Bob?
We're not the same, that's right, but every time I hear a politician say what you just said, you're just giving them another bomb and another bullet, because they're laughing and saying, look, these people in the West, they're not going to fight the way we're fighting, we're going to beat them all day long. Because while we go, oh, we can't do that, it's not very morally good, they'll do everything immoral and beat us every time. You can't fight people when you've got one hand tied behind your back, because all you'll get is a good idea.
Well, we're just going to have to really disagree on this, Bob. I think the idea that we as a community should endorse torture, which is what you're saying, because our opponents might do that themselves, as I say, I just find that morally, it's a totally incomprehensible argument. And also, as I say, the Senate committee report was actually devastating in its conclusions. I know it's been challenged by the CIA and others, and I think the head of the CIA is going to speak before some Senate committee later today, so no doubt they'll tell their side of the story. But one of their devastating assertions in the Senate committee report was it didn't actually keep us any safe. In fact, worse than that, that some of the torture was being conducted. This is what is detailed in the report. And some of the detainees who were being tortured, in order to try and sort of stop the treatment, started claiming that they were involved in plots which were fictional.
Yes.
I mean, how self-defeating is that?
And yet it is also claimed, Deputy Prime Minister, that the location, the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden came through some form of torture of an accomplice. If that was true, surely that is a plus.
I'm afraid I don't think any circumstances justify us abandoning the very values
even
we're fighting for.
Even the location of bin Laden.
I really think.
What about Jihadi John?
I'll tell you what. I think the moment you, as a country, as a people, as a community, the moment we abandon the very values that we claim to be defending, it's actually no longer. So, it's very important. This. It's no longer about whether you win or lose one particular initiative, or whether you find the location of one individual or not. What you actually have done if you've lost the war before you've even waged the battle, because you no longer uphold the values that you claim. And at the end of the day, all conflicts are often about competing values. And if you don't abide by those values, then, of course, you've lost the conflict before it's even started.
But I get lifted in northern Iraq or something later today, and I not only do I know Jihadi John, I know where he is, exactly where he is, and whoever he is currently held captive, I know their exact location. How are you going to get it out of me?
Well, you, of course, there are interrogation techniques, there are question techniques, which are very sophisticated, which are tough, of course, there. I mean, it's not as if we...
How tough can you be?
Well, look...
Can you keep me awake for three days? One of
the big changes which we have introduced as a coalition government, which didn't exist in the past...
Can you keep me awake for three days?
Can I just explain?
Yes, as long as you tell me how far you'll go.
No, I can't, because I'm not... I cannot tell you...
I know where Jihadi John is. He's on the move.
I cannot tell you the precise methods that that can or can't be used in each circumstance. What I can tell you is that torture cannot, will not, and is not being used under any circumstances by British agencies or indeed on our behest. But in order to make that absolutely clear...
You're sure of that?
Now I'm absolutely sure of that.
What about in the past?
Absolutely sure of that. Well, as far as the past is concerned, what we did when we came into government, because there are a lot of allegations and counter-allegations swirling around about what did the British security services know and so on and so forth. So we got a retired, very distinguished judge, Peter Gibson, to look at this. He had a panel. He looked at it all. He wasn't able to conclude his panel inquiry because there are a bunch of police investigations going on at the same time. He published a preliminary report, which Ken Clark explained to the House of Commons some months ago, which said that he hadn't found any evidence of sort of direct mistreatment by detainees, but there were a number of very serious questions. I think 27 questions that he listed on rendition, on knowledge of why were the guidelines not strictly adhered to. He didn't put his punches in saying, frankly, the standards were not being adhered to as the way that they should in those crucial, those crucial days after 9/11. And so another committee, the Intelligence Security Committee, is looking at this. And
Meanwhile, I know where Jihadi John is, and I've just had a couple of hours off. When are you going to start getting aggressive with me?
I think you can... Of course, you can interrogate people forcefully to...
What's that mean?
I'm not a specialist interrogator.
Can you play heavy metal music? Keep me in a white room.
You cannot mistreat and torture people. And that is
how
now...
How are they going to get the information, Deputy Prime Minister?
Well, you can get the information by making sure that you detain them in a way where they know...
I'm a terrorist, I don't care!
Where they know... But hang on, here's the devastating truth that has been revealed by the Senate Committee report, is the idea that you'll get to the truth by torturing someone has been categorically shown to be false. In fact, what some people do in that situation is they make stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
They make stuff up. Sort of straw men sort of threats, which then, of course, consume a lot of energy and time of the mm-hmm. agencies as they go after them, instead of actually finding the truth and keeping ourselves safe. But can I just... It's a very important point. Until a few years ago, we didn't actually know what the consolidated guidance was. We didn't know what the kind of handbook was, if I can put it like that, that you're quite rightly asking about now, which guides how our security services and others will treat, and our armed forces will treat detainees. We've now published that consolidated guidance. We're the first government to do that ever, so it's out there in the open. And by the way, just since you asked about the past, I think once the police investigations are done, once this report from the Intelligence and Security Committee are done, we should keep an open mind, if we need to, about moving to a full judicial inquiry if there are any outstanding questions, because I'm like everybody else. I want the truth out there. And that's one of the big differences. You know, however shocking the Senate Committee report is, it's worth remembering, I doubt very much any state run by ISIL or Al-Qaeda would ever have the maturity to lift a lid on its own mistakes in a way that a mature democracy like America has done.
Let's move on to other questions.
Yep.
Where are we going?
Ahmed in New Malden. Hello, Ahmed.
Good morning, Clegg. Yes, it seems that people in power are able to do anything they want to, and, really no action is taken. It's a good thing America has published this report on CIA, but CIA's job is what they do, what they have been doing for the last 70, 80 years. But, the thing is, what about the Chilcot report? Why has it not been published for the last 5 years?
Yep.
When they're remit to do so within 2 years.
All right, let's move. This is as the Daily Mirror devotes three pages of the paper this morning to having spoken to a number of relatives. We've spoken to some as well, Deputy Prime Minister. They're crying out for this report to be published. Where are we?
I have a lot of sympathy with them. I would like to see this report. I would have liked to have seen it published a long time ago. But I think, as you and I have talked about before, and let me explain, Ahmed, is that when this report was set up, quite rightly, it was set up entirely independent of politicians. If this was run by politicians, people would immediately suspect it to be a stitch-up, that it would be kind of, you know, the government would be judging, or the powers that be, that would be judge and jury of what happened, and that fateful decision to go to war in the first place. A fateful decision that, I should stress, my party was the only party to object to at the time. But because of its independence, I cannot determine, as the Prime Minister explained yesterday, the Prime Minister cannot determine the publication of the report.
Who does?
Chilcot and his co, what are they called, commissioners, I think?
Yes.
Co-commissioners. In other words, the people who are running the Chilcot Commission.
What's it waiting on? What are we waiting for?
Well, Sir John Chilcot will have to explain himself, but my understanding, but I very much stress from a distance, is that first, the sheer volume of material, millions and millions and millions of documents, they've been given unfettered, totally unrestricted access to every single piece of documentation, however secret, however confidential. So they've been sifting through that. But then there's this process, which I guess is just, you know, common sense dictates is just a fair process, is that those individuals, so the politicians of particularly the politicians of the day in the Labour government of the day, that decided on our behalf, in my view, catastrophically and very wrongly, to go to war in Iraq, that those individuals who are in any way criticised or commented upon have a right, which is fair enough, to reply, if you like. They've got a right to reply.
They do, Deputy. Yes, but relatives have a right to know why they lost their sons, their husbands and everybody. And in some cases, the relatives are dying, going to their graves, not knowing how these young men and women lost their lives.
Yep.
How fair is that?
Not fair. At all.
And you're the Deputy Prime Minister, Mr Craig.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, but it takes someone with your muscle to actually say, enough is enough.
Look,
is enough.
I can say, and I have said privately and publicly, and I'm happy to say it again now, I very, very much want to see this Chilcot report published, because it is not fair on the relatives.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
To a subject that we've discussed at least a couple of occasions in the, about 20 months or so that we've been doing. Nearly 2 years. I'm so sorry, it's 2 years next year, what I'm talking about. Nearly 2 years that the Deputy Prime Minister and I have been presenting this show to you. The subject of the Chilcot inquiry has come up a couple of times. Just to remind you, there's a good piece in today's Daily Mirror about this, and they've been speaking with some of the relatives of people whose lives are devastated, and indeed mourning relatives who've lost people in the Iraq war, and they're unsurprisingly asking why the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq invasion has yet to be released. And it would appear there's no prospect of publication this year, and there is a growing sense that, in fact, it will be delayed until post next year's general election, which puts it, obviously, at June time, 2016. Here's the timeline that I'm taking from the Mirror, actually. The inquiry was announced on June the 15th, 2009. In 2010, early 2010, Tony Blair gave evidence. He said there's no regrets on ousting Saddam Hussein. We'll hear a little bit of Mr. Blair in just a second. In 2011, it was the last public hearing, February 2011. Unsurprisingly, since then, relatives have waited and waited and waited. In late 2011, it was said that the release would be put back until at least the summer of 2012. In 2013, there was a row over records of conversations between Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, and US President Bush. In May of this year, David Cameron said he hoped for publication by the end of this year. Yesterday, as I say, there was the warning that it's unlikely to be republished, certainly this year or even before the election. Let's go back to a little bit of the evidence. This is Tony Blair back in 2010.
The crucial thing after September the 11th is that the calculus of risk changed. The primary consideration for me was to send an absolutely powerful, clear and unremitting message that after September the 11th, if you were a regime engaged in WMD, you had to stop.
The chairman, Sir John Chilcot, obviously that's why it's called the Chilcot Report, said in 2009 he hoped publication would take in around 18 months. I've mentioned some of the grieving relatives, people whose lives would never be the same. One joins me now, Rose Gentle. Her life was ruined by the Iraq invasion. She was the mum of Gordon Gentle, a 19-year-old, who was killed while serving in Iraq. Thank you for coming on the show, Mrs. Gentle. This story raises its head again. Why, assuming it is, why is it important that you hear this inquiry?
Well, the families just feel that we need a bit of closure. We need to really find out why our sons or our loved ones are sent into Iraq, because we just keep hearing different excuses over only the past few years.
I think along with Reginald Keyes, someone you know, you have major concerns about the British government's role here, don't you? What is it that you fear might have happened?
We fear now that there's going to be a lot of cover-up on it, and the government's got a lot of input into it now because it's just been going too long. We're kind of worried now it's going to be a right whitewash.
What needs to be done in your view?
In our view, they really need to start coming out with the reports that they've received. The families, the public, they don't know what's going on. Nothing's getting published on the webpage or kept in the loop, so it really has to get pushed for this inquiry to come out now. We don't want it after next year's elections or whenever. We need it very soon.
Do you think there's a bit of back-covering going on here within the establishment, Ms. Gentle?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, yeah, because why are the letters being hidden and there's documents from the government getting given and you've not heard or seen anything about them?
Right. You may or may not be aware the Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, appears on this show each week with me here on LBC, so he's going to be with me about an hour's time. Is there anything you want to say to him?
Well, I'd like him to maybe help me push it for the families to get this and cry it out, or even meet up with families and discuss what help they can give us, because we need the backup on this, because I'm not going to listen to the families.
What would you tell him in that meeting, lastly?
Pardon?
What would you say to Nick Clegg in that meeting? If he had the meeting, what would you say?
We'd ask him why, to give us the help to get this pushed. He needs to do something. The government needs to do something, because it's been on too long. Nick Clegg could help us with us.
Thank you for that, Rose Gentle. You're the mum of Gordon Gentle, a 19-year-old from Pollock, which is near Glasgow in Scotland, who lost his life while serving in Iraq. It must be terribly difficult for you, I know, of course. The papers understandably have pictures of some of these lads in, so yet again you open your papers and you see that. My condolences again, 12 after 8. Listening to that, Dr. Peter Lee, who's a lecturer at Portsmouth University. He looks at the ethics and politics of military intervention. How important do you think it is that we eventually see this inquiry, Dr. Lee?
I think it's extremely important that we see the results, but I strongly fear that we're not going to see all of the results. I think there will be considerable disappointment when it comes out, because a lot of people forget that when the terms of the inquiry were set under the Brown government, departments within government had many rights to withhold information from the inquiry. So I think it's important we see it. I am not very confident that we will see as much as is available to the government, and I think there'll be great disappointment at the lack of criticism of key figures.
Earlier this year, former Attorney General Lord Morris said, "Not to publish is to undermine the whole object. Delay is unjust, and justice to the public is denied." How accurate is that?
Absolutely. I wouldn't argue with that one little bit. It's the people who are paying the highest price for this delay are those who have been harmed personally, wounded personnel who would like to know why they were at war, and also those who are grieving for loved ones who are lost or who have been left maimed. And we ask individuals and families in this country to pay a price for British security, to defend the country, to defend our interests. And I see it as part of the covenant with the armed forces, and by extension, a covenant with the population, that if we ask our citizens to go to war, that there will be a good reason given, and in this case, an explanation why.
Dr. Peter Lee, thank you. A lecturer at Portsmouth University. This is an extraordinary thing, actually, because whatever you think about the United States, and I know many of you have no fondness for it at all, but they have taken a searingly honest portrayal of the involvement of the CIA and what they did after 9/11. And it's as ugly as... We've discussed this already. It's pretty much as ugly as you can imagine. And they've lanced the boil. They're prepared to do it. And it's all out there. And a former president stands in the dock and all the others are scurrying around, either trying to cover their backs or saying that they're all brilliant or whatever it might be. But there is a refreshing sense of honesty as all the cupboard doors are kicked down and everything and the drains are gone through and the sewers and everything else are cleared out and we know what happened. So that brutal honesty, one side of the Atlantic, we now come to the UK, where an inquiry that was announced in 2009, and at that time the man in charge of it said he'd hoped it would take 18 months. So let's be generous. Let's give them, say, till 2011, and that's being generous. And we're now looking at 2015, squarely in the face. Still nothing. So this idea that we fair play, British sense of fair play, what, pardon language, a load of bloody nonsense. There are grieving relatives, some of whom will have already died. Grandparents will have died. Possibly parents will have died. Possibly girlfriends, I don't know. Even boyfriends, I don't know, could have died. Never knowing. How can that be? And yet these same class seek to tell us how to live our lives in so many different ways. If you, like me, and it's good work by the Daily Mirror today, are sickened by this, do give me a call. I'd love to give the Deputy Prime Minister a sense of what you... It's all very well me sitting here ranting and raving, but if I'm out on a peninsula, it sounds a bit odd. Let's get a sense of how you feel about this. What I think is just rank injustice. The break, actually, good point there, of this military covenant. These lads and girls lay down their lives for us, and we can't even take care of their relatives if, of course, it goes ultimately against them. Frank's in Winslow. Frank, you've been on about this before. You've been trying to get to the bottom of this, haven't you?
2 weeks ago today. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
And all I got was a withering and dithering response from a man who tried to exonerate himself from not being involved. He was against the war.
This is Nick. What's done, done. Yeah.
Right? What's done, done. It's history.
Yeah.
Point being is that you've got to congratulate the Americans for actually saying to themselves, right, OK, let's get this out in the open. That will never happen here, because you've got a man who was at the top at the time who covered his backside, but under the 30-year secret ruling, so it won't happen in my lifetime, I'm sure and I hope to God that Blair is actually brought out to be exactly what he is.
What do you think, and providing you don't go completely over the top and libel,
yeah,
what do you think happened here, Frank?
Well, it's the best-kept secret in the UK, isn't it?
I want you to tell me, what is that best-kept secret?
We know full well there were never WMDs. And, you know, Blair was so far up Bush's backside, he could see daylight. That was the whole reason for it. He just wanted to be there.
So when the former Attorney General says, and I'll quote it again, it's pretty strong stuff, not to publish is to undermine the whole object. Delay is unjust. Justice to the public is denied. You feel that quite keenly, clearly, Frank.
Oh, every time. You know, the man in the street doesn't know what's going on because we're never told the truth.
Thank you for that. Nick Clegg here. He'll be taking calls on that, I sense, in a little over half an hour's time. That's from 9 o'clock. It's 8:24 right now. More on that in just a moment, particularly in the light, I remind you, whatever you say about the US, they've pretty much cleared the decks now. The cupboards have been ripped open and we know everything, and it's a brutal, brutal report into what the CIA was up to. And yet here we wait for a £10 million report for probably at least another 6 months.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
So they're seeking to ban another song, and I have to ask, why? Senior Welsh politician wants to ban that iconic hit, Delilah, from being sung at Welsh rugby matches because he says it glorifies domestic violence. It's Dafydd Iwan, I hope I pronounced that correctly, former president of the National Party, Plaid Cymru, and a folk singer. He wants the choir at Cardiff's Millennium Stadium to stop singing it. Should be said, actually, they sing it when they come up to Twickenham and elsewhere as well. The key line is, if you don't know the lyrics, it's about a man who discovers that Delilah appears to have been cheating on him. I crossed the street to her house, she opened the door, she stood there laughing, I felt the knife in my hand, and she laughed no more. Yes, I do appreciate Tom Jones does it slightly better than that.
It's really... I mean, where would you stop banning things? We wouldn't even be able to do three blind mice, presumably. Clive Wolfendale is former acting chief constable of the North Wales Police and conducts the Llandudno Town Band and Swing Band and joins me now. To ban or not to ban? Your view, sir.
Well, Borodar, good morning.
Borodar. Yes.
And can we just start by agreeing that domestic violence is one of the great evils of our age? And
yes.
Let's have no truck with it. OK, I think there's a couple of things going on here. First of all, I was at Millennium Stadium a couple of weeks ago for the Wales-South Africa game.
Yep.
Where indeed Delilah was sung lustily by the mass choirs and about 60,000 fervent supporters, and there was little inhibition about the rendition, let me tell you. So in terms of the song, just trying to pick it apart, I suppose if you look at the nuance of the lyric, this is a song of remorse and sadness rather than celebration, particularly in the, as you say, the extraordinary emotional version by the great Sir Tom.
Yes.
So I think that just needs identifying. But actually, there's something a little more fundamental going on here, because there are lots of inappropriate things that happen before rugby games, arguably. Let's think about the haka, an invocation to war. What could be more blood-curdling than the French anthem, the Marseillaise? And indeed, before the Welsh game itself, South Africa, there were references to Rorke's Drift.
Mm.
The point is that that rugby is in itself a proxy for man's baser and more violent instincts.
Right.
And I guess this is just part of the scene.
Yes, indeed. How popular is it?
Oh, it's hugely popular. If you go to any major sporting event, or indeed any sort of festival across Wales, you'll find this sung by choirs, played by bands, and people join in with passion, along with, of course, many other great songs that originate from the wonderful land of Wales.
Lastly, do you think this will gain any traction, Mr. Wolfendale, or do you think it'll just be consigned to a
pre-Christmas? Well, I think we have to thank David Ewan, again, seriously, for, if he does open discussion about domestic violence, that can't be a bad thing.
Right.
Because nobody in Wales or anywhere else, I think, wants that to be a feature of
society. No, of course. But when I look at the crowds, I see Welsh women and girls singing it as lustily as the fellas, of course.
Well, indeed. Behind me at the Millennium Stadium, there was a group of enthusiastic Welsh women, and their outpourings of national fervour could have been construed as incitement to murder, let me tell you.
Those enthusiastic Welsh women.
You see what I mean? But that's, you know, that's by the by. Of course, Wales has a huge reservoir of tunes to choose from anyway. I mean, its own anthem is the finest in the world, without question.
Well,
and celebrates poets and musicians and language rather than...
All right, sir. I'm going to leave it there. Diolch yn fawr, Mr.
Well done. Diolch chi, croeso.
There we go. Clive Wolfendale. I'll end there, if I may. Former Acting Chief Constable of the North Wales Police conducts the Llandudno Town Band and Swing Band. Now, you don't need to, if you listen to me for any time, realise that I love the newspaper business and I have nothing but respect for people who manage to get to the top job on a paper. It's damn tough to get there. For everyone who gets there, there are many mothers who toil in vain. And to hold the post for just a few years is pretty impressive. To hold it for two decades, as Alan Rusbridge at The Guardian has done, well, that really must take some doing. So, what sort of editor has he been? How has the newspaper business changed in those two decades? We're going to speak to a couple. I don't know what you call a collective noun for a couple of former newspaper editors. Perhaps a murder, who knows? Kelvin McKenzie, former editor of The Sun, broadcaster, commentator, businessman, joins me now. How good or bad was Alan Rusbridge? Kelvin, morning.
Well, it's difficult to judge, really. Average to poor, I would have thought.
Why did you say that?
Well, if you judge him on any level of normal normal business, is how did he do with his sale? It went relentlessly down. How did they do with their profitability under his 20 years? It remorselessly down. And I noticed that there's a lot of chest beating and crowing about the global voice of The Guardian. You want to read their PR spin on this. It's nauseating, you know. And if you judge it by the way that I suspect all your listeners are judged every day, he did a very average job.
Pulitzer Prize, Kelvin, Newspaper of the Year.
Yes, I know, but the only prizes that really matter is, does anybody want to buy it, and does anybody want to advertise in it? And the answer on both of those levels was no, they didn't. And the fact is that only somebody like Rusbridger, under the manner in which they run that paper, which is under a trust where it loses an absolute fortune every year, and they're actually rather pleased in the amount of money that they lose. And, you know, it isn't defined in any sense in a commercial way. And the things they crow about, like Snowden, if you speak to the head of our spying agencies, they will say that it damaged them considerably and may have sent some of the kind of spying employees to their potential death, certainly to their risk.
Kelvin McKenzie, back in just a moment to say how the newspaper business has changed over those 20 years. Staying with the Alan Rusbridge, let's bring Roy Greenslade, former editor of The Mirror, professor of journalism, and indeed media commentator for The Guardian and broadcaster, into it. Fairly withering from Kelvin McKenzie, Roy Greenslade. How would you rate Alan Rusbridge?
Well, I think he's been a superb editor, really. It is true that it's not a great commercial success. It is true that its print sales have been falling. But by early adopting of what we now see will be the future, which is online journalism, he's managed to build a massive audience.
111.5 million unique browsers in October, I read.
That's right, which means Guardian journalism is being read, you know, widely across the world and in Britain, and it still has, as everyone recognises, an amazing agenda-setting appeal. It is true that it is not like The Sun. It is not like The Daily Telegraph. It is a very liberal newspaper. That's the whole reason it exists, because the Scott Trust, which own it, actually say that it must stick to the precepts of liberal journalism. That means anti-establishment, and to an extent, you know, and I hear what Kelvin says about enjoying the fact that we don't make any money, but we don't enjoy it. But the truth is, it is not a commercial entity, in a sense. And I hear kind of Kelvin screaming at what I'm about to say, but in a sense, it is really a public service. It is public service journalism. It's lots of policy journalism. But it has this amazing way, over the years, of still being so important that the establishment, the political establishment, the social establishment, the cultural establishment, take it very seriously indeed.
Well, let's hear Kelvin McKenzie's response. It's public service journalism almost at its best, Kelvin McKenzie.
Well, I mean, you know, there is a like, I don't know how much of it, you know, 7 or 8% appeals to sort of kind of social workers and kind of left-wing teachers and that kind of stuff. But the rest of it is pretty run-of-the-mill stuff. I mean, it carries its football, it carries the city pages, it carries, you know, pretty normal, actually, bizarrely straight down the middle kind of political journalism. So to try and characterise it as having a special kind of place in kind of journalism or in kind of polite society, I don't think is right. I think it's a failure. I think he's been a failure. He's been sitting there writing books, you know, while being paid 500 grand a year by The Guardian to edit this nonsense. Right. And I would have thought that the Scott Trust, of which he's now going to be the chairman, unbelievably, should have had something to say. Why don't you concentrate on editing the paper, matey?
Just lastly, how has the newspaper business changed, in your view, in the last 20 years that Mr. Rusbridge has been doing the job? The general newspaper business now, Kelvin.
Yes, well, I mean, I think, you know, Roy's right. We're watching the kind of fag end of newspaper journalism at the moment, although I must be honest with you, at least in the UK, is massively vibrant. I mean, it's a fantastic effort that everybody puts in every day, but things are clearly changing, and you only have to see the way you get news yourself, which is you go on your smartphone if you want it, or you go on Twitter or something like that, to know that the world is really changing quickly. And that doesn't allow for Rusbridge's efforts, which the fact is that he may get 110 million of them, but none of them have got a penny to spend. They're not buying sofas and stuff, these are.
All right. Kelvin McKenzie, former editor of The Sun, thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Mr. Clegg.
Hello, sir.
Good to speak to you again. yesterday in PMQs, you talked about the lowering of inequality levels.
and deniers. It's simply the fact that the real deniers, all political parties, all the three main political parties, have denied the rights of independence and of a basic future for the one in five people in this country, especially one in five voters, who are deaf, disabled, or their carers. Simply the case. And statistics are meaningless when you compare some of the facts that have happened to me since we last spoke.
Sorry, what is it? Jamie, can you still hear me? The line seemed to click. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, so briefly, you're talking about the inequalities for people with certain disabilities. Is that what you're saying? Pardon my problem getting to the nub of this.
Yeah, sorry, Nick.
It's a terrible line. So your question in a sentence, we're battling a bad line here, to Nick Clegg would be what in a sentence, Jamie?
He talks about the known inequality, but the wants and needs and the rights of the one in five voters that are deaf, disabled and... or
terror,
simply ignored.
I see. Okay, this, of course, particularly becomes acute. I don't know if you're aware, earlier this week, Deputy Prime Minister, there was a story of a bus company that was taken to court, and it seems that someone who has confined, if I can use that word, to a wheelchair, does not have the same rights as a young mum with a buggy. If there's an area on the bus where they can go, the disabled person has to move, and the young mum appears. So, obviously, people such as Jamie feeling, while you talk about equality and you lecture against inequality, what about those with issues, Deputy Prime Minister?
Well, I'm obviously not close to the case, but I'd heard the news about the ruling against the gentleman who'd taken the case. And I mean, Jamie, I'll come in a minute to some of the other sort of policy issues you're talking about, but there's also just an issue of basic, how can I put it, sort of human decency and conduct. You know, I mean, I've pushed for years and years and years little children around, push chairs and got on off buses and trains and all the rest of it, and it's quite a schlep. But, I don't need a law or a court ruling to tell me that if someone is getting onto a bus in a wheelchair, you even if you've got a child with a buggy, you kind of make room. Of course you do, because you're able-bodied and you're able to do that. And I actually think most people and most mums and dads hearing that would have thought that as well. And that's why I really do, I do hope that... and I think, to be fair, most bus companies do take their duties seriously to make sure that there is access for people with disabilities and in wheelchairs onto buses. But I was very kind of unsettled by the idea that the news in this ruling would somehow make people think they don't need to try and just do what actually should come naturally to all of us, which is obviously to help those who are, less able-bodied than others. I mean, Jamie, on the issue of discrimination and money and so on, as you might know, I think the total spending on people with disabilities in our country is now around £50 billion, which is actually higher than it has been in the past. There have been, as you know, controversial debates about a number of welfare changes and so on. But I basically agree with your assertion that every single individual, it's absolutely core to what I've always believed in, regardless of the circumstances of their birth, regardless of their gender, their sexuality, the colour of their skin, the disabilities that they might have, should be able to live the fullest life possible. That's what we should all be about in politics. And that is why I think it is important that we maintain and indeed increase, as we have, the support and spending on disabilities. On the very first point, or your opening of your question, Jamie, I guess my point, this just was sort of part of the kind of shouty yarboo in Prime Minister's questions yesterday, and this is a political point, is I've sat for 5 years listening to the Labour Party talk as if we lived in a sort of world of milk and honey before May 2010, and every single problem, traffic jams, bad weather, inequality, ill health, all were invented by this dastardly coalition government. And so sometimes, yes, I do take the opportunity to remind the Labour Party that pensioner poverty was higher when they were in office than it is now, that youth unemployment was higher when they left office than it is now, that relative inequality was higher than it is now, that relative child poverty was higher. They hate to hear it because their whole image of themselves is somehow that they apparently presided over the most perfectly well-adjusted, utterly, free, happy-go-lucky, problem-free society. It's just a complete nonsense. It's a myth. It's a reinvention. It's a mawkish reinvention of history. And I sometimes think in politics, much as in life, you need to remind people of actually what they did rather than what they claim they think they did.
To emails, Richard Kelly watched you yesterday, Deputy Prime Minister. He writes, I saw Nick Clegg do a terrific job of defusing the achingly dull Harriet Harman in PMQs yesterday. While I don't support the Lib Dems, I commend Nick Clegg for being a persuasive orator and speaking with commitment and genuine emotion around issues he clearly feels so strongly about.
He would be, writes Mr. Kelly, an asset to the Conservatives. Would he consider defecting now that the Lib Dems are relegated to the fourth party?
No, no, and no, Richard. Thank you for the compliments, Richard.
It was going so well.
But it was going so well until that final swerve.
We continue. Andrew, please ask Mr. Clegg, who does he think will be in his chair in the LBC studio after the election, and what would the new show be called?
Ah, well, I very much hope it'll continue to be called, yeah, called Clegg, and I very much hope to continue to see Liberal Democrats in government. I tell you, I make one prediction, and this is perhaps because the bar of expectations has been set so low. The Liberal Democrats are going to do far, far, far better than a lot of the kind of sort of chattering class predictions are presently expecting.
Only months to go. Lisa in Putney, have you had a response yet to your letter to Theresa May where you demanded an apology after her claim in her speech to the Conservative Conference the Lib Dems had put children at risk by vetoing the communications data bill, and did she apologise?
No, but we've continued to sort of...
She's not replied.
We've seen each other. In fact, we saw each other yesterday. In fact, we were talking yesterday, you'd be interested, because I know it's in the papers this morning, we were talking yesterday about this whole issue of the police sort of arbitrarily, basically, you know, going after information held by journalists.
Oh, yes.
Obviously Theresa May and I talked...
Use of Reaper, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
journalists being on bail for 2 years.
Yes, yeah,
exactly. And their lives being put on hold. Yeah. Unable to get mortgages and car loans and go on holiday with their families because they can't leave the country. Things like that, Deputy Prime Minister.
Yes.
I am vaguely aware of
that. Yes, you are. What a surprise. But, in reply to Lisa, we're agreeing to disagree. I thought it was, as I was trying to say, it's not a question of reply. We cross swords on these things all the time. I think what the Conservatives said and what Theresa May said was flatly wrong. It has been flatly contradicted by the facts, and no one has explained to me why her claims were correct. And so I will continue to believe, as I firmly do, that the claims were incorrect when she made them. But just back to the point, only because that's what Theresa May and I were talking about yesterday.
Yes,
yesterday.
Reaper.
Yeah, no, I mean...
You were forced for good here, aren't you, Mr. Clegg? You have major concerns about this bail.
Yes, I have massive concerns. Because, you know, Reaper, which, for those who don't know, what is it, the Regulatory Investigatory Powers Act.
It was meant for terrorism.
Yes, it's not there for the police to go after the kind of, you know, to go after the communications information data that journalists might have got totally properly as part of their professional...
One political editor's mobile phone.
I mean, what I want to see, and this is what I was saying to Theresa May yesterday, what I want to see is I want us to move to a point where the police can only do that, can only go after that information, held by a journalist. And by the way, whilst I always don't always get the best press from my dear friends amongst the media, I'll defend the journalist's right until my last breath as an old-fashioned liberal to go about making life uncomfortable for people like me. That's what, you know, it's partly what journalism is about. It's keeping people on their toes. It's finding out stuff that other people want to hide. It's seeking out the truth that is otherwise being hidden. And you can't do that if journalists are constantly worried that the police are going to arbitrarily kind of bear down on them. And that's why I think that there should be a judge sign-off. Now, Theresa May, to be fair, she's not saying she's disagreeing with it, but I haven't got agreement from the Conservatives to do that now, not least because the Interception Communications Commissioner is producing a report on all of this by the end of next month. And so we're going to... Yeah, I know. No, but hang on. No, but we shouldn't... I mean, to be fair, this is what Theresa May is saying. She said, look, let's not second-guess that report until we've seen it. It's going to come in the next few weeks and then take a judgment. But unless that commissioner's report comes up with something dramatically different to what I expect, I will very much stick to the view that I was saying to the Conservatives yesterday, to Theresa May, that we really should move now towards a position where the police have to seek a sign-off from the judge before they go after journalists in the way that they have.
We move to other calls, Deputy.
Steve in Basildon. Hello, Steve.
Good morning, Mr. Clegg. In the past, your party has advocated doing more for jobs, British jobs and British apprenticeships. Recently, we had reports that we need to import Portuguese bricklayers at £1,000 per week. Mm. I'd argue about that wage, but there you go. English workers actually earn half that. And I do know of two instances where apprentices have fully completed their apprenticeship and not got jobs.
Right.
And yet, don't you think this provides evidence that Europe just doesn't work for British workers?
Steve, just out of interest, do you work in the construction sector? Because this was a report about Portuguese bricking.
I do, and for 20 years, immigration in this country has seriously affected my livelihood.
And what's your livelihood? What's your job?
I started off putting down floors, first fixing carpentry, went into plumbing and heating, moved out of plumbing and heating. I'm now a maintenance engineer for all the new properties that are being built out here.
And in Basildon?
Across London.
Yeah, and sorry, Steve, just because it's very relevant to the... And then I'll obviously try and answer. And just tell me very specifically, in the work that you're doing now, maintenance work, are you seeing that your job and your... or the company you're working for is being undercut or threatened by people from elsewhere in the European Union coming to do that work?
I don't believe that we're threatened. I think that wages are being kept down
right.
purely through immigration.
Right.
And that British companies are no longer backing the British worker anymore.
This is Nick Ferrari. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Last month, it was people in Britain who couldn't make a sandwich. This time, it's people who can't make a house or can't be bricklayers. Builders are hiring Portuguese bricklayers on £1,000 a week because not enough Britons can do the job. It's not even that they want to, they can even do it. Skilled workers are in such short supply, they can demand double the normal daily rate of £100. It was a month ago that the labour shortage in the UK's biggest sandwich company and how they had to go to Hungary, fittingly, of course, because they couldn't fill their production lines with local workers. Portugal, the Daily Mail reveals, is a hot spot for builders. Energy firms are hiring Spanish engineers, so says Manpower, an agency. So why have we lost the ability to be bricklayers? Philip Lagrane is an economist and author of Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them. Joins me now, and your book would seem to be very apt, Mr. Lagrane. We do need them, don't we?
Good morning, Nick. Yes, I think we do. I mean, clearly there is a problem with training in this country, but given that problem, the fact that we can rely on workers from Portugal and elsewhere in the EU to come here to do skilled jobs that need doing, pay taxes and contribute to the economy, is clearly a good thing.
I mean, I know this is an all-encompassing question, and I note in the article also lorry drivers now are getting £1,000 a week, whereas it used to be £500 a week, and again, people from other nationalities are filling those posts. So why is it, I know this is a massively broad question, but why is it that young people don't want to be lorry drivers or bricklayers?
That's a huge question. Clearly, there'll be different reasons. Some people will have aspirations to do jobs that they find more interesting. Other people...
Oh, I suppose everyone wants to be in IT now, do they? All these kids, all the media, something vacuous like that.
People have all sorts of different aspirations and preferences about what they want to do. They might be in the wrong part of the country and not want to travel to the parts where the jobs are. They might not have the right combination of skills needed. There can be all sorts of reasons why that's the fact. But if there are people coming to this country and being paid £1,000 a week, it means that over a year they're paying £15,000 income tax and national insurance. On top of that, they're paying VAT. So they're making a big contribution to the UK economy.
No, there's no doubting that. Lastly, I think the Conservatives said this before the last general election. We can't go on like this. We need to train our own lads and women to build houses and drive trucks and drive lorries. What are we going to do about it?
Well, I mean, that's a bit rich. The government has been in power for nearly 5 years, and if they haven't done anything about it, then perhaps you should be asking them why they haven't.
What should they be doing?
Well, clearly there's a need to improve skills training, which... Right. Successive governments have neglected. They've prioritised university or just no training at all. And sometimes there are firms, private firms, that provide that training. In other cases, they're not willing to spend the money, in which case there's a clear role for government to step in and provide apprenticeships or other kinds of subsidies for training.
Philip Lagrane is an economist and author of Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them, and it appears we do, 12 after 8. I mentioned that this research was done by Manpower. Mark Cahill is the MD, the Managing Director, joins me now. Tell us in a sentence what Manpower does firstly, if you would, Mr. Cahill.
Nick, good morning. We're a workforce solutions company. We help people find work and we help companies to find talent they need to be successful.
Did you have an idea that there might be a problem like this, or has the research really struck you?
No, we've been doing this research for 45 years now, so we predict each quarter ahead what we think is going to happen in the employment market. And this is positive news again for 2015. more jobs are going to be created, tells the survey.
More jobs being created, which is good news. What about this aspect, though, that we can't British lorry drivers or bricklayers?
Well, I think that's a fact. There are skill shortages out there, particularly in the trade skills. We see it in engineering as well. And as you mentioned there, the lorry drivers, truck drivers. And we've seen the truck driver one coming now for a good 12 months or more. In September this year, we were struggling to find qualified, experienced drivers. So it's no doubt that we're starting to see some salary pressures coming through as well.
What do you see happening next?
So I think we will see a slowdown in the driving market in quarter one next year, because I think we've got a seasonal peak. But I think what we need to see is business and education and families getting more involved in terms of job-ready people rather than simply graduate-ready people.
There's a heck of a skill in both bricklaying and in driving one of those enormous lorries, £1,000 a week. It's amazing. More people aren't attracted to it, isn't it?
It's one of those. If you take truck driving, we estimate it costs something like £3,000 to train yourself up now to become a truck driver.
What sort of course do you need to go on to do that then?
Well, it typically would take two weeks to complete that course at least. So you've got to do your theory, then you've got to have a number of hours under your belt in terms of.
And that
of practice.
Costs £3,000.
It
Gosh.
Costs up to £3,000 to train as a lorry driver now.
Okay.
I know for a fact my wife is one. So,
okay, good. HGV.
Yes.
That's a funny name. thank you. I'll give you that one. So once that money's spent, though, and I appreciate that's an outlay, and not every young man or woman can put their hands on that money, right. But you're looking at pulling in perhaps almost 50K a year.
Yeah, but it's there's a shortage now, and 12 months ago there wasn't a shortage in the construction industry, let's face it. There wasn't the work there to be done. We're seeing new jobs being created, and that's the really key part of this. Now we have to attract the skills and develop people so they can do these jobs. It's good news that we're creating new jobs. You look at 2014,
yeah.
We've seen more jobs created than ever. Unemployment has fallen. Youth unemployment has fallen as well. So things are going in the right direction. Very positive.
Thanks for that. Mark Cahill, the positive managing director from Manpower Group. They did the research. People in wheelchairs are second-class citizens, and it would appear that's official. Bus companies are not required by law to force parents with buggies to make way for wheelchair users in designated bays. This all turns on a case involving First Bus. They won a court ruling against a disabled man from West Yorkshire who claimed the wheelchair policy was discriminatory. This happened on a bus in Leeds. Well, we decided to send LBC's Tom Swarbrick out with someone who is in a wheelchair. The commuter is Adam from Tolworth, and this is the first part of his report on getting to a day's work.
We're at the bus stop now, and there's a bus just heading our way, Adam, the K1.
Yes, it is. It's my local route that gets me into either New Malden to make other connections or Surbiton or Kingston again to make other connections.
And what can we expect now? That they'll see us hail, they'll pull up?
Hopefully they'll see me. And
it's not easy to be spotted, is it?
Well, no, not from down here and with other vehicles in the way.
I'll stick my arm out as well. There we go.
Okay.
There we go. Right, it's quite full.
Yes, but the wheelchair space is free, okay. Thankfully.
I'll mind the girls, and then we'll wait for you to get in. Bus is lowering.
Won't work now, it needs to be up.
And they should put the ramp down.
No, it needs to be up to do the ramp. Close the door again, lift up.
The door's shut again. Bus driver doesn't seem to know what's going on. And we're now being looked at a bit by the passengers. This is a bit of a... This isn't the smoothest, is it?
No. Yes. As you see, I'm indicating to the bus driver what he's supposed to be doing. The training for bus drivers and everything is woefully lacking.
Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? That you basically told him what to do. Right, the ramp is down.
Go on.
Girls go on first. And now, Adam.
Thank you.
All right, that's part one. Life on the bus is not all it might be for that commuter. See how he fares on the rest of his journey with LBC's Tom Swarbrick coming up a little bit later. Margaret's in Ealing. Margaret, why doesn't your son or your daughters go off and be bricklayers or truck drivers? Good morning.
Good morning. My son, he tried very hard to be a bricklayer, but it wasn't to be.
Right.
Can I tell you his experience?
Work too tough for him?
Not at all.
Didn't want to get up in the morning?
He was getting up.
Didn't fancy working outside in the cold weather. What was it?
No. He was 17 when he was offered an apprenticeship as a bricklayer with a big reputable company.
Oh, yes.
He did a 3-year apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And he passed all his exams. In fact, he was offered, when he was on site, because they have to do placements.
Did you say 3-year apprenticeship?
A 3-year apprenticeship, yes.
I mean, I'm not decrying it, but to be a bricklayer takes 3 years.
Well, he was with this firm for 3 years being paid on an apprenticeship salary.
I mean, you're a doctor in 5. do you not think it's a long time, or am I being unfair?
Well, it is a long time,
yeah.
Particularly when it actually leads to absolutely nothing at the end of it.
Right.
He did his 3 years, he had 100% attendance, he's not work shy, he got up, he worked, he was offered permanent jobs on 2 occasions when he was on placement, and I said to him, no, finish your apprenticeship, get your certificates and your qualifications, and then go and take a permanent job, which he did.
Right.
At the end of the 3 years, they had a little ceremony, they gave them their certificates, and then they told them to go off and find themselves a job.
Right.
They didn't offer. I thought that he would be offered a job by the firm, and he wasn't. I did contact them and ask them, you know, did they have any advice as to where he would go to look for a permanent job. They had no help, didn't want to know. He was just discarded at the end of the 3 years.
Right.
So he didn't sit around feeling sorry for himself. With my help, he wrote a very good letter, and he contacted the 100 top building companies in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and sent out this letter, putting forward his position, saying what his experience was, and asking for them to employ him.
Mm.
Most of them didn't bother to respond. A few of them said thank you, but no thank you. So he went round to all the local smaller building companies in the area,
mm-hmm.
on foot with his CV in his hand. Thank you very much. Took his CV and nothing.
Right.
So he was unemployed for about 6 months. And he said to me one day, he said, Mom, I'm getting depressed sitting around. You know, I don't want
to. What happened next? What did he do then?
He did another apprenticeship, and
right.
he's now a qualified glazier.
Okay. How long did that take?
That took a year.
I don't understand why it's going to take 3 months to lay bricks and a month, and a year, I'm sorry, 3 years to lay bricks and a year to be a glazier. I don't understand.
Well, I don't understand either.
Well, I want
understand
to understand.
The investment that the firm put in him, him and other young men as well, I have to say, for him to be just cast aside at the end of it.
How did you feel as mum? You must have been very disappointed for him.
I was very disappointed to hear that, and I was absolutely furious with the company because they actually advertise, you know, as offering apprenticeships. I've seen them on TV advertising, and I thought, well, it's all very well offering an apprenticeship, but when you've passed out your apprenticeship, you're not a fully qualified bricklayer.
Sure.
You are then, you've reached the next stage of your training.
But this is, I'm not decrying it for one second because I'm I'm working in a place now, which if the bricks didn't stand up, I'd be in considerable trouble, particularly with a backside my size.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I... This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Benefits Britain, indeed, this is taken from a television show of that name. Benefits Britain, Life on the Dole, is currently on Channel 5. Well, not currently, it's running, the series is running on Channel 5. Earlier this week, you may have heard the story or even seen the story. The show about Roma gypsy Ion Lazar. He told how he'd used £10,000 that he got in benefits since arriving in Britain earlier this year. He spent it refurbishing his home in rural Romania, where his wife and 3 children live. He's entitled to benefits because he's a self-employed status. He has us as a scrap metal dealer in the UK. He spends much of his time in Romania. He spent the £1,200 a month from child benefit and tax credit that you and I give him on a new boiler, a water pump, and a new bath and toilet. He's currently claiming for his older son and daughter, but now plans to sign up his 1-year-old son, Raoul, for child benefit. He expects it to be worth around £500 a month. a month. Right, let's just pause for a second, shall we? There will be north of 30,000 people die this winter. This conversation particularly appropriate as the weather sets in, because they can't afford to turn up the gas. In many instances, these will be people who have paid into the system and the taxes for decades. In some instances, they will be the widows who've perhaps paid in themselves, but certainly they've watched as their husbands and their children have paid in countless thousands of pounds. They have to struggle by an estate pension that comes in at about £100 a week. Their entire working lives in this country and those of their families. And that's what we give them. Meanwhile, for one one-year-old child who doesn't even live in this country, the state will give this man £500 each month, roughly £125 each week. For the love of all that's holy, can anyone explain to me how this bloody system works? How is that right? It doesn't end, as he says. It's like free money. What can I tell you, says Mr. Lazar. Thank you, England. It's helped me. You bet it has. So that's Ion Lazar. What about Evita Kosman? She's a Polish mum. She works in Warsaw, so unsurprisingly, she lives in Warsaw. We don't give her a lot of money, admittedly. It's £2,600 a year. Her husband, Sebastian, is one of tens of thousands of EU immigrants currently receiving payouts from the UK for children who live abroad. I'll give you the annual figure in just a second. The family in Warsaw gets £220 a month in child benefit and child tax credits. This is because Mr. Kosman has an £18,000 a year job in a factory in Bristol. OK, fine, he probably needs help, but the children, for God's sakes, are in Poland. Do you know what she spends the £2,600 a year? Just remind you, 32,000 elderly and vulnerable people will die this winter in Britain because of weather-related conditions, many of them unable to turn up the heat. In some instances, it's heat or eat. She gets £2,600 of our money. She spends it on toys for her pet dog or her pet rat. So as someone in a village, a town, a city where you live, this winter dies, a pet rat in Warsaw gets a nice new toy. And you don't think this is all completely and utterly balmy? Gary's in Ilford. Gary, you're on the radio. Hello.
Yeah, it's good that you raise this issue, but I'm sure that this is an incredible exception to
My friend, stay tuned. In 7 minutes, I will tell you how much it costs. Not now. Fine. After the news and travel. Travels.
I am supportive, but the key point I'm trying to make is that when European migrants or migrants from the world come to this country, they earn good money, they work really hard, provide...
I'm not talking about them, matey.
No, but what I'm saying...
Why bring that in? That would be like if we were having a conversation about Jimmy Savile. No, we'll do it that way. You say, oh, there are plenty of radio presenters who are decent blokes. Of course there are, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about this lunacy.
Indeed, it's all connected in one way, that money goes abroad to be used in services that could be used here. So all the benefits are given, and as well as those who work...
We can find dustmen next week.
I know, it's all connected because... We are actually allowing people to export the money that's earned here rather than use it in the services and other things that we need. It's gone abroad. And benefits payments is such like this. This lunacy that you just mentioned is quite right. It's not just in EU. It happens to those from other countries. And it's wrong. It's a system that allows it, Nick.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. So you agree with me. Never mind we should phase this out. I would, honestly, if I was Prime Minister, it would be stopped by Monday. And if it wasn't stopped, whoever didn't stop it would be fired by Tuesday. It's not hard.
Yeah. I mean, I do agree with you in that sense.
Good.
But it's a system that allows the money to be exported is totally wrong.
Good.
And whether it's in the form of benefits or anything else, it should be used for services and goods that are made by industries in this country. So it helps the economy. This leakage doesn't
help the economy. Please don't give me that helps the economy. Please don't give... That is a fatuous argument. You may as well say, well, instead of giving her 2,000, let's give her even more money. It's a fatuous argument.
But unless you resolve that issue, you can't resolve this.
Well, I can resolve it because I'm stopping it now. End of. There's no conversation to be had. It stops, right? You live in this country. Your children... You have to prove your children are in this country. By the way, I'd phase the money down. There should be individual responsibility. You know, it's like the state always picking up the cheque. Gary, thanks for getting us started. Max is in Wembley. You're on the radio. Max.
Hi, Nick. You're right.
Yeah, I'm good. What are you going to tell me?
Well, I'm going to tell you that. Oh, it does travel.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to tell you that I'm Polish. I came to UK 10 years ago, and I worked so incredibly hard. I'm running my company, and I'm doing well now.
Well done. What is your company, Max?
It's a commercial laundry.
Ah, right,
we're washing the linen for the hotels and the restaurants.
Ah, very good.
What they're doing is not fair. It's not right. Incredibly not fair. And I hope the government finally will do something with it. Because then, obviously, like you said, they're living in Poland. I can't say the reason why we, our money from the UK, sending to the Poland.
Ridiculous.
What's the point?
Ridiculous.
And like I said, I hope the government will finally will do something with it. We'll stop it.
Well said, and good luck with the business you run. Woods that we had more people like you. You're employing people, you're providing a service, you're paying your tax. Nothing but support for people like you, as opposed to others, where we're sending out £10,000 to pay for a boiler in rural Romania. Michael's in Wimbledon. Michael?
Hello, Nick. Nice to speak to you. First time caller on your programme.
Welcome,
I'm
sir.
I'm an immigrant myself as well for the last 8 years. Mm. I'm from Romania. I worked hard in the last 8 years. I'm running a company myself.
How many people do you employ?
I only employ a couple of people.
No, that's good.
Working company.
Good on you.
But
well done.
Still, I think it's not fair. And I totally agree with your previous caller. The government needs to look at the benefit system and sort this out. It's not fair. I pay my taxes. I don't get anything. I don't want to get anything. I came here to work and to do something for myself and my family by my own means. Not by the state.
Woods that everyone was like you as well. Michael of Wimbledon, it's great having people like you. Thank you. This conversation continues. Also coming up after a travel update, one of my earlier callers there, Gary, seeming to debate, well, it won't be that much amount of money. Really? Really? I've got the figure in front of me. The amount of money we spend every week or month or year, I've got it all, in handouts that go overseas. £600,000 every single week goes in money to people overseas and for child benefit. Mark.
Wow, 600 grand a week. So yep. That's about £30 million a year, isn't it?
It is. You're 31. Gosh, you're quick. Wow.
My goodness. So my point really, Nick, is I guess I just want to echo what the other guy's saying in terms of I think it's ridiculous as a country. You know, people, it's hard enough here as it is without us having to pay out to people who are overseas, whether it's people sending benefits out, or whether it's the government giving a big house in Marylebone, you know, a big £2 million house to a family of eight in Marylebone because they've got nowhere to stay. I think it's really unfair. I think the more pertinent question, Nick, though, is why is the government such a soft touch? Why is the government so much softer in regards to this than other European countries? That's the burning question that I'd really like the answer to.
I'm going to make a mental note. I'll try and remember to put all this to Mr. Clegg in just under a week's time. What do you suppose the response will be?
I think it'll be some fluffy response that as a country we have to be responsible for, you know, the well-being of people who may not necessarily live in our country but have an affiliation with our country by someone who lives here. Something really, really fluffy like that. I really can't think of a credible response, hence the question.
Stay tuned. It's a few days away, but you make a very good point, Mark. Thank you. Have yourself a good weekend. More on that in a moment. We're also talking about a very difficult subject, male rape. I say again, for the I think at least the fourth time, I completely accept that it can happen as children and that people are tragically victims of that, which can blight their entire lives, and I completely accept that it could be an aspect of a homosexual relationship. A heterosexual relationship? That's what I'm struggling with a little bit. And the sort of numbers that might be there. 9,000 victims of rape or attempted rape. Now, that will include some gay. I get it. But really? Andy, you're in Islington. What are you going to tell me, Andy?
Good morning, Nick. Just wanted to make the point that earlier you said that rape was about force. It's about consent, not force. Recently, the law changed to say that a woman cannot give consent if she's drunk. Hence, we have that case with the footballer recently.
Yep.
So it's just making the point that rape is about consent, not force. Now, it's very difficult to talk about rape on the radio, but you mentioned the physiological side of it.
Yes.
Just to try and deal with that diplomatically, if I can. The way I put it to you is that if a woman showed any physiological signs of arousal, you would not say she had not been raped.
Right.
So So maybe you need to think about it. As I said, it's very difficult to talk about it.
Mm. But the male partner of the act has to be ready for action. And if he is in any way being bullied, coerced, harassed, threatened, I don't know how conducive that would be to what is about to take place.
You could say the same about a woman, but they could
sadly no
physiological reaction.
Well, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I see what you're driving at now, but
okay.
Sadly, there is a way that the process could continue that perhaps it would never get off the starting blocks as regards the male, if you know what I'm saying.
I do, but I don't agree with you, because I said there could still be that physiological reaction. Can I just go one step further?
Well,
remember on one occasion...
Yeah.
It's careful, don't worry. Yeah. I remember on one occasion I was in a room with about a dozen guys and just talking generally, and somebody said, "Had you ever had sex with a woman and you didn't want to?" And then every male in that room nodded.
Yeah, hang on, that's not... Hold on, that's not rape. I mean, sometimes you're... Golly, let's go. Sometimes you're tired, you've just had a fight, you didn't... It's just... But you just know, it's like a duty, isn't it? You just, it's going to be easier just to do it than not.
That could be the case in some of those...
I don't class that as rape.
Cases that, well,
can any of us honestly say we haven't done that?
If it was the other way around, that would be rape.
I think there'll be some women listening now who possibly just think, you know what, I don't know that I have that much interest. I'm more worried about the fact that Amazon hasn't delivered the kids' kids' Christmas presents. But do you know what? Just for a quiet Saturday night, fine. It's not against my will, but it's not like I'm fully signed up to this. Are you telling me there aren't women listening to this right now who've done that, possibly on a regular basis? Thank you for that.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM.
How could a broadband connection grant help your business? I'm here with the MD of MyPA, Emma Mills, to find out.
MyPA provide virtual PA support to lots of different kinds of businesses. And for us, because we are virtual, it's crucial that we have a super fast connection all of the time. It was when we moved offices we discovered that we could get a grant from the government of £3,000, which covered the installation of the super fast broadband. I'd say to any company, go for it. Superfast Broadband has made such a difference to our business.
Businesses may be eligible for a grant of up to £3,000 to upgrade to a superfast broadband connection. To find out more, visit connectionvouchers.co.uk.
Moving office is one of the most critical business decisions you will ever make. When designed, planned and managed well, it could reduce real estate costs, improve efficiency and increase profitability. Speak to Maris Interiors, who've been designing, fitting out and transforming workplaces for over 3 decades. Book your free consultation, attend a free seminar or get a free guidebook. Go to officerelocation.co.uk. Maris. Workplace design experts.
Wouldn't a printer which comes with enough ink for 2 years be amazing? No annoying interruptions and no ink cartridges. Introducing the new EcoTank from Epson. With high-capacity ink tanks instead of traditional ink cartridges, it comes with enough ink to print up to 4,000 pages in black or 6,500 pages in colour, saving you up to 65% on average on your print costs. Pick one up in-store or online at Currys PC World and start saving today. Epson EcoTank. Say goodbye to cartridges.
118434. 118434.
What are you doing?
Trying to remember a number.
Do you want to borrow my pen?
118434.
Now there's only one number to remember. 118434. The handy number for handy numbers.
Calls cost 76 pence plus £1.53 per minute from a BT landline. Other networks vary and mobiles cost considerably more.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Jamie Oliver, you heard him towards the end of my conversation with London Mayor Boris Johnson. I have the sole studio space now just with Jamie and your new book. It's called Comfort Food. Jamie Oliver, define comfort food. What is it?
Comfort food is the food that you look forward to. It's like the food that makes you feel like you've had a big old hug. It's food that taps into memories, nostalgia. So, of course, you've got the sort of legit basics like, you know, the ultimate lasagna, shepherd's pies, you know, curries, roast dinners. But, you know, even baked beans on toast, you know, what does the ultimate look like? So I think this was an excuse for me after 15 years to actually concentrate, give a little bit more space to, like, the tiny details that make something super special.
And it sounds almost as if it's in the right season. It sounds like it should be a sort of autumny, wintry kind of thing from some of the food you were describing.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's definitely brilliant for this time of year.
Yeah.
And I think, like, emotionally, I've waited 15 years to do this. I mean, over the last 15 years, I've sort of systematically gone through every excuse why not to cook, you know, whether it's time or money or sort of availability. And I think comfort really is actually the opposite of all of that. It's like, right, it's the weekend. It kind of starts Friday night. Let's just put some time and thought into something awesome, incredible, not convenient and delicious and, you know, but actually something that you're going to invest a bit of love into. And I think, you know, I think cooking, like all good things, has different gears that we all want a little bit of everything.
We're talking the day after one newspaper, the Sunday Express, published a story now that, not routinely, but you can count in the 20s the number of bariatric surgery procedures that are given to 13-year-olds, to children, because of the vast amount of weight they've put on. Are British mums, are British families becoming more aware? Is there more education to be done? How come, sorry to use this word, but how come we have so many fat 13-year-olds?
Well, I think it's you know, it's not just the 13-year-olds, it's parents, even pregnant women is if you talk to any doctor or paediatrician, you know, really, I mean, we've, you know, it'll be 10 years next year since the school dinners campaign.
Is that how long it's
and
been?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the one thing I've learned in that time is that it's great that we're looking at secondary school and primary school especially, but there's loads of work to be done in nursery schools and the second that a woman gets pregnant. So, you know, I think food, I mean, that's my big passion for the last 10 years. And I don't know if you're aware, but 2 months ago in September, it was made British law that every child will be physically taught how to cook and about food and where it comes from and how it affects their body. This is a massive sort of win, really, for the kind of the school dinners.
What do you hope that will achieve, Jamie?
Well, I think, you know, it's taken 10 years to get politicians to sort of embed it into education, because all of the data categorically says that if we feed our kids right at school and teach them about food, then you're more armed with a population that, A, can look after themselves, but also their future family. But also, it's, you know, up to about 10, 11%, it helps. If you feed them right at school, it helps them learn and attainment's higher.
How do you teach your own kids?
Just fun. It doesn't have to be boring. Just get them involved. You know, I think...
Who's showing themselves, do you think, as being most interested in food?
Well, I don't think you have to be a chef to sort of benefit from the wonderful world of food. I think just being aware of basic... I mean, the thing is, mate, I mean, it's... Look, my kids grow up in my house. There's all sorts going on. We grow a lot of stuff. We go to a lot of markets. They see a lot of stuff around the house. Subliminally, they're picking up stuff all the time. I do think one of the strongest things, actually, a parent can do is just take them to a farmer's market. You don't even have to buy anything. Just go there once a month for an hour. You'll have a great laugh.
What will the child get? What will he or she soak up?
The people that go to farmer's markets are wonderful artisans most of the time, and their job is to sort of just give the love of that product. So just by being there and having a cup of coffee, that child over the course of 10 years will just be very aware of most of the important things about food and where it comes
from. See cheese in the raw as opposed to being wrapped up in that cellophane that
strangles
the life out of it.
And know what good tastes like. You know, the thing is, we're not programmed to eat, you know, horrible, highly processed food with low nutritional value. It's just, it becomes about access and the local area and, of course, budget and all those things. But, you know, the interesting thing, whether it's time or money, you know, the most powerful thing about eating well is knowledge. It's you know, of course there's a big argument about cost and time, but not, you know, some of the best food on the planet has always come from the poorest communities, but they do know how to cook.
When was the last time you were driving along and you just couldn't be bothered and you had to go into one of those service stations and have a hamburger or fish and chips, or you just don't allow yourself to do it?
It's not so much... I mean, these days, actually, it's not so bad. You've got all sorts of sandwiches and wraps and sort of bits and pieces. I mean, I'm not anti... you know, I grew up as one of the kids that would go and have a birthday party in one of the pirate ships in a McDonald's and stuff like that, and we had a great time. I think, you know, the thing is when that becomes like a normal part of your nutrition, that's a problem. So I think I haven't done it for ages, but, you know, I think I've got into the point now where I want to be more kind of holistic about sort of, you can have a bit of what you want, but you just got to kind of put the
balance. Bedrock, it.
Yeah, you got to have.
It.
The good stuff.
You're not just an author and a TV personality and, of course, a chef. You're also a businessman now. How many people do you employ up and down the land, Jamie?
Well, just in restaurants, it's about 4,000.
How's the economy doing?
I think the interesting thing actually in restaurants is you see and feel the start and end of the
Well, you catch it first normally, don't you, with the building trade.
I think, you know, the margins in restaurants are quite small. I think that people think it's it's much easier selling shoes than it is, you know.
You're not going to do that next day.
it would be much more straightforward. The sort of investment and rates and everything involved in running those businesses are massive. I think we're slowly coming out of recession. It feels like confidence is definitely there. Interestingly, spend per head is up by about £1.50. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it is.
No, you put that across up the north. Chain, yeah.
So in the north of England, they seem to be a little more confident than the south. But, it's nice to be coming out of it.
We're talking about how important it is for children to learn to cook and everything. I've been handed a note that you actually nearly set fire to your manhood once. You were talking on the television about this.
This story is going viral. yes, I did. It was a Valentine's Day, yes. And I was trying to be romantic. And I felt at that early... I was a bit younger. And I thought that it would be intelligent to cook naked. And I had a new oven that was gas... that was fan-assisted. And there was humidity created through the whole sea bass that was being cooked. And it was burnt. And it was one of the most painful things I've ever had happen. And it was bittersweet. and it was a frozen peas job, I'm afraid.
I can imagine.
It wasn't the romantic night that I thought it was going to be. So I can't endorse anyone doing what I did. Let that stand to be an example of what not to do.
And now, in 30 seconds, tell everybody, Jamie Oliver, if you would, why they have to get Jamie's comfort food.
Well, it's if you pick it up and feel it, hopefully it will speak for itself. It's 100 of the best comfort food dishes from our lands and all around the world. And the lucky thing is pretty much every shop discounts it by 2/3. So for a tenner, you know, it's a lovely Christmas present. So
it's out by Penguin, you say that. Yes, it perhaps says a little bit more on the cover, but you'd be sure to pick it up. It's actually presented beautifully, isn't it?
With it's in a plastic wrap just so that no one sort of, you know, touches it up. So it's perfect for you.
Always good seeing you. Best to the family.
Thank
well
you for
done
having
with the business.
Me.
And thank you for joshing with Boris Johnson. It's
thank you very much.
He's a good bloke. Jamie Oliver, comfort food. Jamie's comfort food. I'm done. Boris, I thought it would be useful for you to meet a best-selling author because Jamie Oliver's books rocket. Jamie, welcome to the
studio. Hello, sir. Yeah, what conversation have I walked into?
Yeah, it's just the usual argy-bargy about water can. That's all. Jamie, I'm delighted. It's a great honour to see you again.
Lovely to see you too.
Anyway, as I was telling Nick, we seldom eat anything else except what you advise us and guide us.
And I've got to ask you, with all the restaurants, the thing that's front and foremost, Jamie, we're going to talk more about your book after a travel update in just a second. With all the restaurants you run, what's your policy on breastfeeding? Because Boris Johnson's just told us, providing it doesn't involve adults, he's completely relaxed.
I think the mayor is absolutely right. I think, you know, empowering women to feel comfortable to do what is right. I'd be appalled if I found out any of my managers had a problem with it. It's certainly not something that we endorse. We want women to feel, you know, they have their own ways of doing it.
Yeah, it's from spirit, that's right.
You know, I think you want to make them feel as comfortable as possible, whether they do it wherever they want or there's a special place you can find for them, anything.
All right. Yeah. So, as one best-selling author, TV personality, pin-up and cult hero departs the studio in Boris Johnson, and I wish you and all your staff a very Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. This is our last one before Christmas.
Well, unless you want to come in next week, by all means.
Happy.
And the same to you, and of course to all the team who work with you.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.
Good morning.